He who makes a beast of himself gets rid of the pain of being a man.
Good day to you, ladies and gentlemen. This is Trevor T. Trujillo, and this is the Nighthawks podcast. And this is
Matt Foster, the other person in the booth.
And we are film critics over at fanboytv.com. You can find
and we're
our
calling at the booth now.
Our booth at the Nighthawks Cafe. You can find our reviews over at fanboytv.com. You can also find show notes for this episode as well as other episodes. So be sure to check us out. I don't know, we're coming up on 30 episodes. I don't think we're quite there yet. We're still playing with the structure a little bit. So be sure to get in touch with us. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at Nighthawks Pod. You can also leave us reviews and ratings, and you can subscribe over at iTunes, as well as a number of other podcast aggregates. Get in touch. Let us know how we're doing. And we're doing something not wholly new to the show, but something a little apart from norm. But first off, Matt, how are you? How is Central Utah?
I'm okay. Central Utah is drug free.
Unlike our movie today.
Yeah.
Off the top of the show that if that is something that is in your no-fly zone, if drug abuse is not copacetic to your style. I don't know if that's a thing. I don't know. Are drugs a trigger warning thing? Is that something we give trigger warnings for now?
I'm not sure. Honestly, I'm triggered by trigger warnings.
We are going to be dealing very heavily with drug abuse and not necessarily in the DARE resistance education fashion. We're just going to be talking about people who do a lot of drugs.
And crude humor throughout.
Yes, always. We generally do two movies per episode on the show. We'll find a movie, we'll find something else to pair it with, we find some commonalities between them. Boom, we have a Nighthawks episode. Sometimes we have a single movie. We feel that we have a lot to say about this film and that we can occupy the full 45 minutes to an hour on this one film. So you have episodes like Christopher Lee's Hammer Films Dracula. You have episodes like Pontypool, which was not too terribly long ago. This is going to be another one-shotter.
Or sometimes, like in the case of this movie, there's just really nothing that goes with it.
I don't know about that. I think we probably could have found a few things to pair with this, but I think we would have been
maybe
doing...
Maybe another Terry Gilliam movie, maybe Brazil.
Well, you know, why beat around the bush? We are talking about Terry Gilliam's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
You want me to go to Las Vegas at once? As your attorney, I advise you to rent a very fast car with no top. Tape recorder for special music. Get the hell out of L.A. for at least 48 hours.
We're all set. If I could just get you John Hancock, you're on your way.
Yeah.
Listen, you're going to be real careful with this car, right?
Oh, yeah, man.
Stop here. This is bat country.
God damn, I never rode in a convertible before.
Get out.
You can't park your car here.
Why not? Is this not a reasonable place to park?
Reasonable? You're on a sidewalk.
What's the score here?
Lucy paints portraits of Barbara Streisand. God
bless.
Hell, look what you're doing to your car!
Someone should stop them!
Please, are you people crazy? What are we doing out here on this godforsaken road?
The airport's over there, man!
I've never missed a plane yet.
Pictures presents the story that defined a generation. Johnny Depp.
Hey, good morning, how are you?
Benicio del Toro.
Let's get down to brass tacks here. How much for the ape?
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. A Terry Gilliam film.
All right, now I've got to go.
What's up, lunch?
Radio, man, radio.
I think, you know, we could have paired this with Where the Buffalo Roam or with Rum Diary or any of a number of movies. I think we could have paired it maybe with The Hangover or something, but I think that would be doing this movie a disservice. I think it's a good movie. It's got a lot to say. I think it's well-crafted and deserves to be talked about for 45 minutes to an hour. So any thoughts on that, Matt? Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. And I think I wanted to specifically mention a commonality this has with something in theaters, which is Hail Caesar.
Oh, really?
This is a movie that gets mentioned when someone criticizes this. They often say it's plotless or it doesn't have what you call a linear enough story. Because, I mean, it is a drug-fueled bender. It's the story of two guys on a bender. Hail Caesar is very similar in that the actual plot here is about a personal realization. It's not actually the events are not the plot. When they're viewed in the light of driving the realization of being part of the introspection that is the actual plot, they make a lot more sense.
No, that's an excellent way of putting that for both Hail Caesar and for Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Which Hail Caesar is another episode, but I just wanted to it deserves a little plug.
Sure, you know, it's in theaters now, and it's worth seeing, if nothing else, just for the craft of it, to see Joel and Ethan Coen kind of playing in the sandbox of classic cinema. You know, they do get to play a little bit in what it would be like to shoot a Roman epic or a Million Dollar Mermaid or, you know, an old-timey Tom Mix Western. So it is a lot of fun, but before we digress too fully, you're absolutely right. I mean, you can watch this movie, and I think a lot of people do watch Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas as a just a series of drug vignettes. A couple of guys who do drugs, do some crazy stuff. It's kind of fun to watch. It's really funny if you watch it stoned. You put it on at a party, and it's easy to miss the subtext of it all. But the subtext is certainly there, and this movie, I think, is very, very specifically structured the way it is. I think Terry Gilliam did a hell of a job on this movie with the way it's structured and the way it works.
To synopsize the plot of Fear and Loathing, a journalist is assigned to cover a motorbike race in the Las Vegas desert for a magazine. It was Sports Illustrated in real life. I don't know if it's named in the movie. And so he and his lawyer thoroughly abuse their expense account, end up not doing their original job, but the notes they take about their glorious failure end up being more marketable than the original article would have been. We have to talk a little bit about the style of Hunter S. Thompson.
I mean, this is based on a book, which is in and of itself based on a magazine article in Rolling Stone, which is in and of itself, to some unknown degree, based on real life, but it's the writings of Hunter S. Thompson, the self-described doctor of gonzo journalism.
Every time you watch this movie, the topic, did it really happen like this, comes up. Raoul Duke, who is Dr. Thompson's alt in the movie, and Dr. Gonzo, who is his lawyer, they are, I don't know if fictionalized is the right version. There are conceptual versions. It's more like the relationship between like an Andrew Dice Clay on stage and off stage than it is a fiction versus nonfiction issue. It is the antithesis of The Hangover. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is the story of a weekend in Vegas as it appeared while you were on the drugs and drinking the alcohol. And instead of the parts you can't remember being glossed over and the cleanup being detailed, it is the parts you can't remember are detailed and the cleanup is glossed over.
So
the way these guys are acting and the events as they're depicted, it's not that they're trying to put forth that they really got away with all this and it really happened exactly like this. It's more that they're trying to put forth that this is how they thought they were acting when they were probably half comatose for half of it. And I think the movie does a good job in depicting that, because there are moments in the movie where they sober up and re-examine the locations and the people they've interacted with. And they're key moments in the movie, which is, the way I would put it is, it's about partying in Las Vegas the way MASH is about Korea, which is to say it's actually mostly about Vietnam.
No, that's a good point, but I think it is about Vietnam, but it's about a lot more than Vietnam too. It's really about a really bumpy transition between 1969 and Woodstock and the Summer of Love and Peace and Joy and Haight Ashbury and Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix and transitioning into 1972 Nixon America. What a culture shock that was to somebody who so fully embraced the 60s.
Well, and it's also about a moment in the career of Hunter S. Thompson when he effectively decided to go from journalism to satire.
Hunter S. Thompson really is in a class on his own. That sounds like a platitude, that sounds like me being hyperbolic, but it's not. Because nobody really does it like him, and anybody that tries is a pale imitation. I think Hunter S. Thompson nailed this niche, branded it perfectly, and there have been a few imitators, but there has never been another Hunter S. Thompson. And it is to the degree where you don't know how much of this is actually true. A lot of it you really hope isn't.
I think we've watched the Criterion edition of this, which has Hunter S. Thompson, Raoul Duke, is played by Johnny Depp, who utterly inhabits Hunter S. Thompson. With the full... there was a previous attempt at a Hunter S. Thompson movie starring Bill Murray. It's good and funny in its own way, but it really focused more on what a pain in the ass he was to work with. It was much more of a piece of if Man in the Moon was more about actually having to deal with Andy Kaufman every day. It would be more like Where the Buffalo Roam, the Bill Murray movie.
Bill Murray is the outrageous, the infamous, the totally glorious Dr. Hunter S. Thompson.
You know, I hate to advocate drugs or liquor, violence, insanity to anyone, but in my case, it's worked.
Fear and Loathing is more like, it treats the alter egos as more dominant and real and gets into what they were really like. And in the Criterion edition, there is a commentary track with Hunter S. Thompson and Hunter, I don't know if he was married to her at the time, but I believe she became his wife, is aide-de-camp, a woman named Anita. She says to him, "So Hunter, you guys didn't actually do all this, right? You played it up a little bit for the movie." And you hear him go, "No, Anita, this is pretty much exactly what transpired." Hunter S. Thompson might have had a medical marijuana card, and he might have been doing bong rips while they were tracking the movie. There's a slim to 100% chance. At one point, I remember reading something where he describes Johnny Depp as being... for someone that is such a clean-cut young lad, he does a good job of inhabiting my vices. That's what he says. Some words to that effect. I'm sure I've murdered the actual quote. But it's these guys have this Bacchanal in Las Vegas on their expense account. And then at one point, Raoul Duke fears that Dr. Gonzo has disappeared or become deceased. He heads back to L.A. in a fury in their rental car. They drove from L.A. to Las Vegas. So he's pounding it back to the desert and stops to make a phone call. And who picks up the phone but his lawyer, who is somehow beating back to L.A., probably by plane, and is now neatly pressed and dressed and says, Hunter, don't you remember? I booked you another assignment. You need to turn around and go back to Vegas. Yeah. And the other assignment is covering a policeman's gathering regarding the drug culture. Hunter S. Thompson goes to that still with his brain still essentially radioactive on drugs. And I don't say drugs, by the way, to be nonspecific or to use a euphemism. I say it because I mean drugs, plural. The guy was on a lot of different What does he say at the beginning?
We had 2 bags of grass, 75 pellets of mescaline, 5 sheets of high-powered blotter acid, a salt shaker half full of cocaine, a whole galaxy of multicolored uppers, downers, screamers, laughers. Also a quarter tequila, quarter rum, case of beer, pint of raw ether, 2 dozen amyls. Not that we needed all that for the trip, but once you get locked into a serious drug collection, the tendency is to push it as far as you can.
But so they get pretty rippity-doo-dah, and then they go to the law enforcement conference, and which is a fiasco, and after which they get even higher. And then essentially there's this kind of set of moments of clarity, usually in the early morning hours when everything kind of worn off and the city of Las Vegas was quiet, and you get to hear what would ultimately make Hunter S. Thompson's bones, what would make him truly enshrined as a countercultural figure, which were the initial skeleton of this article that was published in Rolling Stone when Sports Illustrated wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole, called Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, the title of the movie, one assumes not coincidentally. And we get to the basic topic at hand, which is that at some level, he expresses it in nautical terms. He says, if you sit in Vegas and then you look west, you can see where the high water mark was. And he's referring to the countercultural movement and what a time and place it was to be in San Francisco in the 60s.
Strange memories on this nervous night in Las Vegas. Has it been 5 years? 6? It seems like a lifetime. The kind of peak that never comes again. San Francisco in the middle 60s was a very special time and place to be a part of. But no explanation, no mix of words or music or memories can touch that sense of knowing that you were there and alive in that corner of time in the world. Whatever it meant. There was madness in any direction, at any hour. You could strike sparks anywhere. There was a fantastic universal sense that whatever we were doing was right, that we were winning. And that, I think, was the handle. That sense of inevitable victory over the forces of old and evil. Not in any mean or military sense. We didn't need that. Our energy would simply prevail. We had all the momentum. We were riding the crest of a high and beautiful wave. So now, less than 5 years later, you can go up on a steep hill in Las Vegas and look west. And with the right kind of eyes, you can almost see the high water mark. That place where the wave finally broke and rolled back.
And you got to remember this, and this is something that's come up in the show before, and I think we'll see it again before too long. It's the discussion of pre-internet meme and how things kind of very slowly developed and ideas caught on very slowly. It could sometimes take 10 years for an idea to make its way from either coast to the American heartland. Clothing styles and things like that. I lived in a community in central Wyoming when I was growing up that was still very 1970s, even though it was the 1980s. We were about 2 or 3 years behind.
It's made fun of in How I Met Your Mother when they say the Canadian 90s were just like the American 80s.
Yeah. So basically what you have is this discussion of this explosion of the hippie movement out of San Francisco and how far it radiated before it started to implode on itself. Between the character Raoul Duke and Dr. Gonzo, who is the sidekick character in the narrative, the conceptualization of the real-life attorney Oscar Zeta Acosta. We'll talk about him in a second. He's a character unto himself. But there is a lot of discussion about the American dream, and I think ultimately more than, obviously more than an article about a motorcycle race, this is really kind of Hunter S. Thompson's eulogy for the 1960s, and his quest in Las Vegas searching for the American dream is searching for his American dream. It's searching for his 60s. It's searching for that weirdness that is San Francisco. Maybe you can find it in this tidal pool in this really crazy town called Las Vegas.
And by its nature, the quote-unquote American dream is fraught with the fact that what is the American dream? It's a set of privileges that different people are going to use in a different way. Hunter S. Thompson, his American dream was to use his given freedoms as a human, as a sovereign being, to do what he wanted with his own social life and sexual life and brain chemistry, and to say what he wanted to power. And to another person, the American dream might be adequate donut supplies, you know? We use that term all the time, but we don't really clarify what it means. And it's very strange to me, because what he's talking about is that he thought, you know, they thought the revolution was here. They thought something was really going to change at the end of the 60s. And awareness changed. The world changed a little bit, but it was like, at one point, you know, the hippie movement really thought it was going to overthrow something. They thought a true wave of electoral or even real rebellion was going to happen. And instead, it was more like, all right, you made enough noise. Sit down at the table and we'll give on a couple of your points. You know, maybe you can have an equal rights amendment. Maybe we can get more women in office. Maybe we can clear up the whole Jim Crow thing, but quit while you're ahead. And Thompson was very much lamenting that.
Well, and I think Thompson, like you said, was very concerned about the self, too. And I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but I think Thompson was a very self-centered, self-focused writer. I mean, everything he writes is obviously
autobiographical. Everything eye language.
Yeah, everything he says is through his lens. Obviously, you know, you're always viewing things through the author's lens, but Hunter doesn't make an attempt to do that. He doesn't make that journalistic attempt to be non-partial. He's there, is what's happening, and these are his feelings about it. But it's not enough for him as a gonzo journalist to just tell you what's going on. He wants to give you the experience of what it's like to be there yourself. And I think he does that in both the book. I think Terry Gilliam does that in the movie.
Well, and the other thing going on with him is, I'm not sure it was about himself and his autonomy. It was about that, but I think there was also an element of, he despised the abrogation of autonomy just for the sake of theater. Like, I wish to God he was here today to write about the modern TSA, you know, about one shoe bomber, so now we all take off our shoes, about how you have to get patted down and x-rayed to go on a plane when they demonstrably do not check what they put in the cargo. You know the notion of security theater, and post 9/11 they put 10,000 cameras a square mile in Manhattan. None of them are pointed up. None of them would have stopped what happened. And the notion of political theater that is absurd working, like the idea that because these people want to demonize something, or they want to change something, or they want to have a little social control, or they're pursuing a secondary agenda, so they do something like outlaw marijuana. We all know it's silly. Just like we all know that, really, to be honest, the president of the United States is not the most dedicated family man. But they all have to make a show of it. We don't elect single presidents, you know. And that was the sort of absurdity that Hunter S. Thompson despised. That was the kind of thing he set out to skewer.
Well, and I think in Fear and Loathing Las Vegas, he goes out to Las Vegas looking for the last bastion of the 60s, the last place where you can go and get absolutely tuned and have lots of anonymous sex and party and be destructive or be constructive or be artistic. And you're not judged. You're not judged and you're not persecuted.
He's also highlighting something he got into in the Rum Diaries, which is the story that takes place in pre-communist Cuba, which is that all the people that came down and cracked heads on the counterculture, they themselves spend their weekends in places like Havana and Las Vegas. That the people that are not judging and letting you do everything in Las Vegas are the same people that judged you when you did it in San Francisco. I think an attack on that hypocrisy is throughout Fear and Loathing.
Well, I think the disillusionment is that Hunter S. Thompson gets there expecting a hippie's paradise, and what he actually gets is the seed of capitalism. The 80s, what would be the Wall Street greedy 80s, the Gordon Gekko 80s, was born in 1970s Las Vegas, where they absolutely monetized everything. They put a price on everything. They branded everything. It is corporate mecca, and it is the exact antithesis of what Hunter S. Thompson was looking for. He wanders into the pit of hell, twisted on drugs. And Hunter is not complimentary of Las Vegas in this book.
I hate to say this, but this place is getting to me. I think I'm getting the fear.
Nonsense. We came here to find the American dream. Now that we're right in the vortex, you want to quit? You must realize, man, we found the main nerve.
That's what gives me the fear.
Look.
What?
There's two women a polar bear.
Don't tell me those things. Not now, man. This is my last drink. How much money can you lend me?
Not much. Why?
I have to go.
Go?
Yeah. Leave the country.
Oh, come down. You'll be straight in a few hours. Just sit the down.
Oh, around, man. This is serious. One more hour in this town, I'll kill somebody.
Well, I'll tell you what. I don't even think Hunter S. Thompson necessarily sat down at his desk and said, what is the best way I can satirize Richard Nixon or George W. Bush or 9/11 or any of these multiple things that he's written about? I think he just kind of does a stream of consciousness thing where he lets his emotions and his hyperbole get in there and keeps it, because it's particularly kind of well written. He's a hoot to read.
Yeah, and I'm not sure by the time he gets in his writing mood, I'm not sure his editing discipline is there anymore.
Well, I think a lot of what I mean, if what I know and what I have heard of Hunter S. Thompson is true, I'm pretty sure a lot of what we see published in Rolling Stone and in magazines, in the articles that are collected in his various collections and books, I think a lot of what we're seeing is all first draft, written about 5 minutes after deadline.
Personally, I've always been of the opinion that his process probably involved heavy editing by the bevy of assistants he's always had, because he always kind of has a handler translator figure.
Yeah.
So he's this very strange, larger than life icon who got a lot of money, and he's a little bit of a Salinger figure in that he was very prolific in sort of column space and correspondence and public speaking, but he really did not write that many actual books. He was, and you can sort of speculate as to his relationship with drugs. Did they ultimately enable his career, or would he have been more brilliant and longer lived without them? But you can't go back in time and make the guy anything but what he was, you know?
Well, and he was very about doing things on his own terms, right up to his death by suicide.
I've never gotten any hard confirmation with it, but the supposition has always been that he was terminally ill and didn't want to linger.
I do know, I believe it was in one of the afterwords that was written in Rolling Stone, did a really nice tribute to him. I believe there was a remembrance in there where they were talking about how he was in a wheelchair in the last years of his life, which is something that Hunter would not have cottoned to. This is the type of guy who likes to, he has a comp or had a compound in outside of Woody Creek, Colorado, just so he could go outside and shoot guns naked into the night, you know, just so he could do not get in trouble.
And his you know, he didn't follow anything close to a typical circadian rhythm. Let me see if I can find, did you ever read the itinerary of Hunter S. Thompson's day?
Oh, yes. It was written by somebody else, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was written by a biographer. Yeah, here we go. A Day with Thompson, Shivas, Dunhills, and Cocaine. This is attributed to the Associated Press. But Hunter S. Thompson's daily routine is both predictable and outrageous, if not apocryphal. According to E. John Carroll's biography, Hunter, The Strange and Savage Life of Hunter S. Thompson, it goes like this. "3 p.m. Rise. 3:05, Shivas Regal with the morning papers, Dunhill cigarette. 3:45, cocaine. 3:50, another glass of Shivas, Dunhill. 4:05, first cup of coffee, Dunhill. 4:15, cocaine. 4:16, orange juice, Dunhill. 4:30, cocaine. 4:54, cocaine. 5:05, cocaine. For lunch, Heineken. 2 margaritas, 2 cheeseburgers, 2 orders of fries, a plate of tomatoes, coleslaw, a taco salad, a double order of onion rings, carrot cake, ice cream, bean fritter, Dunhill's, another Heineken, cocaine, and for the ride home, a snow cone, a glass of shredded ice over which is poured 3 or 4 jiggers of Chivas. 9 p.m., cocaine. 10 p.m., Hunter drops acid. 11 p.m., chartreuse, cocaine, and grass. Eleven 30, cocaine. Don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody to love? Midnight. Hunter is ready to write. 12:05 to 6 a.m. Chartreuse, cocaine, grass, Chivas, coffee, Heineken, clove cigarettes, grapefruit. Don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody to love? Wouldn't you love somebody to love? You better find somebody to love.
I think we hit on something, that this is a very deep, very poignant movie, and it's you're right, it's not about the series of events, although the series of events are important and they're what make the movie entertaining on a certain level. But I think this is also a very serious introspection about Hunter S. Thompson, and it shows his growth as a person.
I'm not sure growth is the right word, but it's about a transition that happened in his life and in his work where he effectively, and I remember, God, I couldn't tell you exactly where it is, but there is a piece of one of his short columns talks about being in a riot in the 60s, about when law enforcement came into violent contact with protesters. And he talks about huddling in a doorway and mentioning that that was the first time in his life when he came to the, he says, and I paraphrase, up to that moment, I had thought that if I marshaled sufficient explanatory power, I could reach people. And during the riot, I realized that it wasn't that they were unaware of my points. It was that they did not care. They found the same things I was pointing out as pretextual and false. They understood they were pretextual and false and agreed with the deployment of the pretext. I think Fear and Loathing is a less direct way of expressing that, that if the world was not going to play ball, he was no longer going to use his explanatory voice to orate for change. He was instead going to use it to highlight absurdity. And so it marks this moment when he went from chronicler to sort of iconoclast.
I do want to talk a little bit about the movie specifically. We talked a little bit about him, the man, and a little bit about the writing. Terry Gilliam does a hell of a job bringing this story to the screen. It's not a literal translation or adaptation of the book, but it's pretty darn close. Scenes parallel very well with scenes in the book, although you may not necessarily be seeing in the same order that you would read them. Terry Gilliam kind of has this weird way of showing things in flashback and fast-forwarding in time, so it's not a linear timeline. But it makes sense when you watch it, in as much sense as this movie can make any sense at all. And it's just so visually rich. I mean, the color palettes are perfect. The set designs are out of this world. The cast, the extras. I don't know that there is an uninteresting looking person in this movie. They're all exceptional in some way. They're all interesting to look at. And I know you were talking about seeing some of the background elements, how you see new stuff every time.
Yeah, the degree of detail and planning that has gone into this sort of nightmare Las Vegas that they're in when they're really screwed down tight is amazing, particularly In what they call in the movie the Bazooko Circus, which is the circus. In the book, it was named as the Circus Circus Casino, which was a circus-themed Las Vegas casino that I think is still there.
Last time I was there, it was still there.
But now it's, of course, in major disrepair. But it was sort of the first attempt at a Vegas casino that had something for kids to do. And that tried to be family-friendly.
A drunk person can learn to cope with things like seeing their dead grandmother crawling up their leg with a knife in her teeth. But nobody should be asked to handle this trip. Bazooko's Circus is what the whole hep world would be doing Saturday night if the Nazis had won the war. This was the Sixth Reich.
There's a trapeze sequence that just defies explanation.
and I can't even play the clip. It doesn't make for good radio. But I think most of that whole sequence is mostly Terry Gilliam. And it's Terry Gilliam illustrating how bizarre this world that Hunter S. Thompson, or that Raoul Duke is walking into.
The particularly adept thing they do is then... Like when they're in the circus, all the like carnival attractions in the background are kind of twisted and horrific. And then later, when they go back through the same spaces, they're remarkably more comprehensible. Like they cover sort of the fact a lot of it is just in their heads.
There is a lot of craft to this movie, and especially in the design. It was not enough to shoot this in Los Angeles and then... shoot a few exteriors in Vegas and then film in a casino down in Torrance. No, they built a weird kind of a casino set that would fluctuate with how badly the two lead characters are on drugs. Almost if you can imagine like a balloon or a diaphragm kind of heaving in and out is kind of how this operates. As it expands, things get more twisted and weird. And then as it contracts, it gets a little more normal.
You know, an important note about drug use in movies is really, you know, this is another one like The Big Lebowski or I mean, there's essentially the only way to put this is to say there's two kinds of drug movies. There's drug movies made by people that have done them and people that haven't. and Fear and Loathing is in the former category. Like Terry Gilliam is clearly knows what he's talking about. So...
I do want to talk, Johnny Depp just kills this part, especially if you watch like archive footage and old interviews with Hunter S. Thompson. Johnny Depp really inhabits this character and did so with permission by living with Hunter S. Thompson for something like six months.
Yeah, in fact, an interesting note is that Hunter Thompson donated a bunch of, well, not do- loaned a bunch of his vintage clothing to the production. And Johnny Depp is of a size to wear it without much modification. So a lot of time he's in the actual things Hunter S. Thompson was wearing. You know.
Well, you know, we were talking about earlier in the episode, we were talking about Where the Buffalo Roam and how that's about how Hunter S. Thompson was kind of a pain in the ass. That's not an incorrect point. He was notoriously hard to deal with. You know, I always used to fantasize when Hunter S. Thompson was still alive and I was a little more young and rambunctious about, you know, we didn't live an unreasonable distance from where he lived in Woody Creek. You know, it would have been a several hour drive, but it was doable in a day. And friends and I talked about, I think you and I may have even talked about, you know, what it would be like to go down there and what it would take to get in the front door.
Oh, I don't think it would have taken much to get in the front door. I think it would have taken being at the bar he frequented, being there for one of his little... He kind of liked to go there and hold court.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think everybody retired to his place for the after party. It wasn't... I don't think it was all that hard to meet the man if you were in the right area. It was, for all accounts, pretty outgoing. But only in his odd way, which might be everybody come out and we'll have steaks and do lines, and then an hour later being like, oh, too much sensory input, everybody out.
Yeah.
You know
we've mentioned Sparky on the show before, but Sparky and I always talked about just saving like $2,000 a piece, getting a case of Wild Turkey and driving down on Super Bowl Sunday and hitting the buzzer on the door and saying, we have come to drink hard liquor and gamble. And we were pretty sure that would have done it.
I don't know why you guys thought that would take $2,000. This is just 6 hour drive.
Just to gamble with, you know. It, you know, we would sincerely, we would want to gamble with him. We would be new money. We figured that would be an enticement.
When you put it that way, yeah, I don't see you out handicapping him. So probably would have been good to just write that money off.
Exactly. And you know, it was not something that we dismissed as a flight of fancy either. I mean, this was something we kind of sort of talked about doing. He passed away later that season. And, you know, obviously there goes that.
Well, and he was also notorious for not wanting to speak in any venue that wouldn't let him smoke and drink on stage.
Right, right. And see, I think as an adult, like looking back on that, you know, if Hunter was still with us, I would want to go hang out with Hunter. But I don't know that I would have been as endeared or charmed by him as a as an adult. I think he's the guy that never grew up. And the older you get as a person, the less you'd be able to relate to him. Which is not to say that he didn't have adult friends. He did. But, you know, I had roommates that I'm pretty sure living with those dudes, not saying anything against them. They are who they are, but they were real notorious old school rock and rollers who never really grew up. And they were hard to live with as, you know, great to have a party with, but hard to live with as a roommate. We mentioned it a little bit, but you were noticing some of the background gags, or not really gags, but just some of the background elements that make this movie just a little more surreal, like you were on kind of an acid trip.
I think another notable production detail is this is loaded with cameos and walk-ons. And yeah. I mean, what is there? There's Ellen Barkin, Christopher Maloney. Who's it?
Cameron Diaz.
Greg Bierko. I don't know if you'd count him as a cameo because he's not maybe that famous to anybody but us.
And also Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers was in there. From the impression that I got, it was a lot of people who really admired Hunter S. Thompson who wanted to be in on this project. So you've got all these familiar faces kind of peeking their heads in, and then you've got all these weird background elements. Like, at one point, Raoul Duke, the only time in the movie he's actually covering what he's been sent there to cover, he is out on the racetrack. It's a desert. They're just covered in dust, riding around in a Jeep, and it's almost like combat. And then Hunter S. Thompson, in his trip, starts seeing helicopters and gunfire. And by the time they're approached by another Jeep, we're not actually sure how much of that is a hallucination and how much of that is real.
Yeah. Well, and I love his...
What the... That's the machine gun. Yeah, machine gun. We got a new war zone, man. Get us out of here, quick. Quick, man. Quick, we're going to be killed for a second. What the... Oh, no. Oh, God. Oh, God. Where's the damn race?
Beats me, man. We're just good patriotic Americans like yourself.
What outfit you fellas with?
Oh, the sporting friend. We're friendly. Hired geek.
that's one thing. This movie is intensely quotable. Like, there's so many.
Oh, God, yes.
You walk out of this and you will be repeating stuff from it for days.
So really, it is something I think people should check out. I don't think we spoiled anything. I don't know if this movie is necessarily spoilable. We didn't talk about a lot of the particulars. We didn't get real granular with the scenes, but I mean, those are the things that they're best to experience. They're best to read. They're best to watch on television.
One thing we should throw a note out. We haven't even said the words Benicio del Toro.
Oh, that's true. Benicio del Toro is playing Dr. Gonzo, a.k.a. Oscar Zeta Acosta, who we also said we'd mention. But, yeah, Benicio del Toro does a hell of a job. Hunter S. Thompson is a guy, he doesn't have an angel on his shoulder. He has two devils. And then when he takes drugs, one of those devils goes away and turns into Benicio del Toro's character. He really is the antagonist in this movie, not necessarily in a James Bond mustache-twirling villain manner, but a lot of the bad stuff that goes down because Dr. Gonzo cannot handle his drugs.
Well, I don't think anyone could handle his drugs.
Yeah, Benicio del Toro, hell of a guy. He's playing Oscar Zeta Acosta, who was Hunter S. Thompson's real-life attorney and was also a very outspoken Latino rights activist, to the point of being a controversial Latino rights activist, to the point of being somebody who was not necessarily about equality as much as he was about bringing down the man. He didn't necessarily like white people. Hunter S. Thompson seeming to be an odd addition, but Hunter has written to that if you seek it out.
He was the sort of counterculturalist that was about tearing down the power structure. You know, he's the kind of person who's of the opinion that anything was better than this. So he was going to make a hole and see what grew. And so he was sort of terrifyingly, wantonly iconoclastic. Well, and he was definitely in that kind of that Saul Alinsky, Weather Underground, you know, people who by the victorious side of history have been characterized as domestic terrorists.
Right.
These were people who could and did, in fact, get rough, physically rough about their politics. And particularly with the current, you know, the Occupy movement and the Black Lives Matter and the current political climate, it's so relevant to if you look back on the 60s with a data-driven mindset, you realize, like, you know, we like to start talking about how, well, the culture's so divided right now. It's like people, shots were fired in the 60s.
Yeah.
Protesters were fired on in this country. They were tear gassed and shot and had dogs put on them during the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. This is not foreign to our idiom, like we want to pretend it is, because we're coming off of a couple of relatively good decades in the 90s and the 80s. We were sort of unified by exterior forces during the what would you call them, the aughts?
Yeah.
Now we've sort of. I don't think this is new. I think we're picking up the ball where it was dropped in 69. And again, the topic of mental liberation and sexual liberation and class warfare are back where they maybe should have been the whole time. And we're again on that edge of seeing what comes next.
Well, and that's why I have always really been acutely troubled by Hunter's death. Now, once again, Hunter does things by his own rules, and nobody was going to talk him out of it, out of taking his own life. And certainly the pleas of a 20-something fan of his that he's never met before are not going to weigh real heavily on him. But I would have loved to have gotten his perspective on what's going on now, on what's going on with Black Lives Matter, on what's going on with the presidential election, with Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders being kind of these weird outlier upsets, and how weird the political game has gotten. His quote is, "When the going gets weird, the weird turn pro," and Hunter S. Thompson was king of the weird. I think some of his best writing, obviously I'm biased because this is the time that I was conscious in and I had a personal stake in, but his writing post 9/11, his book The Kingdom of Fear, prolific stuff, scary stuff, good stuff.
I remember there was a great poker player named Stu Unger that he ran back-to-back World Series and then flushed a couple decades down kind of drug abuse and debauchery. And then I believe, and this is what I read between the lines, but I believe he knew his death was imminent from compromised health. And so he came back and, like it was a trivial task, won another World Series to get some legacy money to sort of spread around and deal with his obligations. And then he passed pretty abruptly thereafter. And I think Hunter S. Thompson at one point was probably on the edge of losing his legacy to his sort of desire to retire on the mountain and kind of take pot shots from afar. And towards the end, I believe he was galvanized again. It is a shame that he went when he went, because another 5 or 10 years of him might have been a hell of a thing to behold.
Especially in the time of like a Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert, who kind of in their own way, doing their own thing, but definitely picked up that satire torch and carried it to become a whole new thing, which was also interesting to witness during that time in our history. It's like being in the throne room when the fool comes in to mock the war in front of the king.
I don't know, man. It was a weird deal. Different time back then.
We joke about it, but it was. It really was. It's a lot of people were saying this in the wake of David Bowie's passing, and I think it's especially true with those of us who were alive for Hunter S. Thompson. I forget there's an entire generation of people now who were not alive for Hunter S. Thompson, but... we are just fortunate enough that we got to be here for the short time that he was. You know, geologically speaking, he was nothing but a flash in the pan on that scale of time, but we got to be there for it, and we got to see why it was special. And so that's really cool, and I think there's a lot of love from Terry Gilliam, and especially a lot of love from Johnny Depp. And we see that in this film. We see a love note to Hunter Thompson. And it really is a wonderful, wonderful film.
This is a strange place in time. And I think it's salient to look back and say that not so many decades ago, this stuff was happening. And I think we blinked from the moment of transition and we punted. And I hope in 5 or 10 years, we're not looking back on the high water mark.
Yeah. Well, on that heavy note, I think it's coffee and pie time.
Just made myself a little misty.
Yeah. That was a moment, man. Yeah, that was good pod. Only here, only at Nighthawks can you get that moment. So, follow us on Facebook, Nighthawks Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Nighthawks Pod. We are also on iTunes and several other podcast aggregates. If we're not available on the one you use, let us know. We'd love to, get in touch with more people. Beyond that, our show notes and reviews are available at fanboytv.com. But Matt, any last thoughts before we dive out?
The only thing I have to say is how much for the pie? How much for the whole pie?
I'll tell you what, start peeling singles off your money roll and she'll go comatose when you stop.
Three, four, five?
All right. Well, folks, that's going to do it for us. It is coffee and pie time for Matt and I. We are going to wrap this thing up because it's almost morning.
The question mark was emphasized.
Backdoor beauty?
I can't escape. Oh, mama, can this really be the end? To be stuck inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues again. Shakespeare, he's in the alley with his pointed shoes and his bed.